bit of a change of tone now. I'm going to talk to you about fish. If you're vegetarian, you might not love this. Especially with such a big screen in such a small room.
And the light stands up in the eyes.
Anyway, here goes.
So no pictures of Helena Bonham Carter, I take it.
Sorry?
Have you seen Helena Bonham Carter's new campaign?
No, I haven't.
Where she's straddling a fish?
No, I need to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I need to see.
And she's naked.
Okay, interesting.
Don't stop eating.
Let's not get distracted already. So, the buying and selling of fish, it's a slippery business. I mean, quite literally, and for the ways in which the process of trade escapes our grasp. That's what I'm really interested in. But although we know there's massive price dispersion in fish markets, it's very well documented by economists, and that highlights how value doesn't reside in the good itself. In this paper, I'm trying to suggest that attention to the mundane aspects of trade can really illuminate how value is established in practice around key moments of interpretation, care, exchange and interaction, and through sensory, amongst other knowledges, and I'm going to focus on some of the sensory aspects here. So the paper is based on research I've undertaken at Billingsgate Fish Market. It's London's wholesale fish market, the UK's largest inland market, some of you might know it. It's located since 1982 on the Isle of Dogs in East London next to Canary Wharf, after moving out of the City of London where it was based for several hundred years. And I spent quite a lot of time at Billingsgate, generally following fish, trying to figure out what it is that happens there between people, to fish, in space, and how this sits within a kind of wider socio-economic cultural process of getting fish from sea to table. And that's the bigger project that this is one part of. So the field of work for this part of the project was mostly conducted in the autumn of 2012. I made 2 to 3 visits a week, mostly through the night. I was on study leave. And aside from hanging around with and without a camera, I carried out about 25 formal or informal interviews with fish merchants, salespeople, porters, inspectors. And I also shadowed fish inspectors and porters as they went about their work and spent lots of time in the CAF and talked to buyers and other workers there. So I'm interested in paying attention, as I said, to the everyday activities of a bunch of people who could easily be overlooked, especially under these looming towers of high finance that you can see Canary Wharf through the windows of one of the cafes on the Billingsgate site. And I'm interested in the work that goes on in Billingsgate to produce value. And there's lots of reference on the part of fish merchants at Billingsgate to what's happening outside, and jokes about this is where people think trade and money changes hands, symbolically, but actually it's down here in Billingsgate. So following Hertz and Moll's discussion of the good tomato, which I've taken a lot of inspiration from, this paper asks, what are the everyday judgments that fish merchants make about the fish they buy and sell, which contribute to the process of valuation? And what is it that fish merchants do? How do they act in the valuation process to enhance or diminish value and to create or sustain buyers' attachments? And in the meantime, what is it that the fish do? This is Billingsgate at 4 o'clock in the morning, which is when trade starts. There's a bell that goes. You can see the clock at the top there. A bell goes at 4 o'clock and you know trade can begin. There's a pre-sale viewing time before then. But no fish is allowed to leave the market until 4 a.m. So in the rest of this paper, I'm going to focus on 3 key moments in the life of the market where fish merchants, they deploy their sensory knowledge around quality and fit, configuring and performing the properties of the fish and the buyer. So the first is about caring for fish, then on about the practice of the sale, and then fish without value. So, thinking of caring for the fish. It's not too gruesome, I hope. The stands, these, what we might usually think of as a stall, are called stands at Billingsgate. The stands where the fish is sold, they present samples, and most of the fish is held in storage areas. These samples require sorting, organising, displaying, and the fish needs to be maintained in some kind of liminal state. And in a way, it's the fragility of the fish, which is a kind of sad fact that underpins all the attention it receives. It's relentlessly iced, checked for temperature, aestheticised and staged in the sphere of exchange, as Bond puts it. And although it's no longer living, apart from the lobsters, who don't have a happy time, it's as if it's not quite dead either, gleaming with water and light, and the best fish is described as stiff alive, still in rigour. Knowing your fish is a real currency in the market and in the process of exchange, and buyers and sellers both get valued accordingly. But knowledge is specific, it's embodied, and it underpins sight and touch. You need to know how to hold the fish, the texture of the flesh, the pressure to apply. And that's a part of the everyday sensory understandings of the fish merchants and the way that they're working to sustain value. So in seeking to match fish to the buyers in the market space, what the fish merchants do is shift from a kind of evaluative register, which is identifying, first of all, what counts as a good fish, to a performative register, where they actually do something to the fish and in relation to the buyers to maintain at one level its value and then produce value in the moment of the sale. So fish merchants and salespeople, they care about their fish, they love their fish. They talk about it with feeling in terms of beauty, like the sensual appeal that Hertz and Moles talk about in relation to the tomatoes and the buyers and sellers that they spoke to who speak in those registers. So they talk about tending the fish, that the fish needs TLC, and it's sometimes kind of a deliberate stance against a more generalised disgust of fish and seafood encountered in the general public, some of the general public. But however much the merchants care for their fish, they cannot save it. The just dead fish do things by themselves. They nonchalantly sit there and perish and spoil and create panic and anxiety. Every moment that passes, they're losing value. Everyone that walks past and there's no sale, the value is potentially diminished. They can sometimes be reinvigorated, though. And Roger Barton, who you may have come across on some of the BBC programmes about Billingsgate and other fish markets, is very fond of telling stories where he's managed to get fish that other people thought was no longer fit for consumption and somehow magically revive it. He recently got prosecuted. Thinking about the sale, then. This is him. Billingsgate trade takes place pairwise, so it's a one-to-one negotiation as opposed to the process of trade at an auction. And this form produces particular kinds of activities, interactions, spaces. So deals are made in this one-to-one way through swift gestures and quick judgments. And speed is really important in finding the right fish at the right price. We can see Roger here, and when talking to him, he explains he starts making calls to people, letting his best customers know what he's got at around 4 a.m, offering first refusal on things, updating them on orders, letting them know what they'd like for tomorrow, and he's sort of managing stock, price, competition and relations, all along multiple temporalities, but especially into the future. So orders aren't singular moments, they're these processes that move backwards and forwards in time. And wherever the sale takes place, whether it's at an auction or in a market like this, the fish must never, so even if the fish can't be seen, which it can't at many auctions, the fish must nevertheless be alive in the minds of the buyers, and first in the minds of the sellers, to animate their judgments. So valuing we see is a process, a practical possibility and achievement. And for one fish merchant, Jim Roberts, for him, value is secured when the right fish goes to the right buyer. And in this, anticipation is key. So he describes his work as very satisfying, providing this first-class commodity. You can be proud of what you sell, he says. And sometimes he says the fish will just sell itself by the look, but then a moment later he starts talking about stories which kind of belie that statement. So, and this is happening in a conversation that I'm recording between him and one of his colleagues, and one of his colleagues is saying, oh, he's thinking ahead all that time. And then Jim says, you can just see the fish glistening, and you think to yourself, I've got just the customer who'll buy that. So matching the customer up to the quality of the fish is really important. And his other colleague says, he doesn't even know where that fish is going to go until he sees it. Now he thinks, hang on, And then Jim says, Rex, the customer, is still in bed, and I've already sold it to him. So he's anticipating who's going to come in and who is going to be the right person for that fish. And so value is achieved in the moment of the sale. Now, I'm presenting that's happening in this pairwise way between a single buyer and a single seller. But actually, this is also happening in a space. And the kind of combination, the collection of those kind of social and economic relations in this space, in this tightly defined temporal frame. So the market is open at 4 a.m. Many people finish by 8:30, but it closes at 9:30. It produces a particular kind of atmosphere in which valuing happens at a social and collective level, a particular quality of feeling about the environment. And there's lots of that creates its own kind of intensity. And like you mentioned, Daniel, about people looking around the markets for pre-sales, there's lots of checking what other people have got before the market properly starts selling. The third key moment is when fish are condemned. Fish are declared to be without value, and it's the most intense moment of contest over value in the life of the market. When the fish and the fish merchant come under the gaze of the fish inspector. Now here, the visual is the privileged mode of knowing. Well, it's a privileged mode of knowing in the fish business in any case, in time transcending the need for touch or smell. So as Bill, one of the fish inspectors, tells me, there's a kind of first floor balcony at Billingsgate where you can look down onto the market hall. And I'm standing there up there with him, asking him what he can see. And he says, I can see quality at 50 metres. And I don't actually think that's bravado. I think it's his skilled vision, as Grassini puts it, that's come from years of looking, of training the eye for a specific visual attentiveness. But he likens himself to a border guard, and he says, we're always looking, constantly looking, at the fish itself, but also at the trucks and the conditions of transportation, the boxes that the fish come in. Now, this deployment of the senses, it matters a great deal in thinking about evaluation for the fish that pass through Billingsgate and for the livelihoods of the traders there. Inspectors have the power to condemn fish unfit for human consumption. And it's a kind of looming threat when they're walking around, which they do in kind of random times each day, especially for those fish merchants that are trying to shift stock that might be borderline. And when they see the fish inspector get out their little pad and then make a note of it later in the office in this ledger of all the register of fish condemned and surrendered, and then they put their big C on it. That's when you know it's been a bad day. The fish merchants not only lose any potential value in monetary terms from that stock, they also have to pay for the fish to be destroyed. And that's why the condemning of fish is really making the fish without any value for any end. The fish is sent to an incinerator. It doesn't go, it's not moved further down the food chain. So it's really that there's a contest there between trying to hold on to value and watching it disappear, and then there being a kind of a price to pay for negative value. So it's tense. When I was shadowing the fish inspectors, these were tense times, and I could have my notebook there as a researcher. They didn't all know who I was. So I felt that kind of tension also directed to me as they assumed I was looking with a similar kind of vision. And it's not for the fish that survives the market as if it's a happy end. Valuing may lead to destruction, as Hertz and Moles point out in relation to tomatoes. While eating tomatoes performs tomatoes as good to eat, it also finishes them off. And that's a lesson for us. So, to conclude, just to say I've focused here on the activity of valuing, the labour of fish merchants, and drawing attention to the role of the sensory in everyday market lives. And we've seen how valuing is something that they do, they imagine, they perform through embodied and sensory engagement, literally hands-on judgments and interventions. Thank you.
Again.
You want to go first?
Mm.
Okay. She's my friend, you should go first.
What is that?
That means they're not friends. But
all right. I see, yeah, the contrast. I can go first. I was just wondering about the fish, right? This is the focus of the sort of object plan. And there's the fish, obviously, they don't come from Billingsgate, right? I mean, they kind of, they're there being presented, and then, but they're in a moment of transport in some way, right? I don't know how to phrase this really, but they're coming from somewhere and they're going somewhere.
They are.
Yes. And how does that play out in your study? I mean, I'm not saying necessarily that you need to follow the fish sort of from
no,
the sea
to
where.
Oh,
you are? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right, I was going to ask. So there's a sort of methodological question, but also, within the market itself, how does that travel sort of present itself? I can sort of see when you're talking about lining up the seller. The perfect buyer for the fish, that's kind of lining up its further movement, but also presumably where it's come from, that sort of travel is also somehow there as well.
So the first part of your question about where the fish comes from more generally, I am interested in following the fish. I started it backwards, so I went to a retail market first of all, and did some work at Deptford with Les Back, and then went to Billingsgate and spent a little bit of time at different ports. And I'm planning on doing more work in that direction. But what I know from being at Billingsgate is that there's fish that are sourced from many different places around the UK, so it's an important market for fish is dispersed, brought to Billingsgate as a point of concentration, then dispersed again to hotels, restaurants and fishmongers' shops. There's also a very important trade that comes in from abroad. So lots of fish from the Indian Ocean, from South America. It's completely global, and that tends to arrive by plane. So there are lots of implications of how the fish is treated along the way there. And the second part of the question, which was about the circulation of fish within the market. So the picture that I showed you of the market hall is only one part of the market space. So around the edges, you've got two very large chillers where most of the fish sits, because this is a samples market. So the buyers come along and they look at the sample of fish and then take a sealed box. And it's the porter's job to, who had a very interesting and significant role at Billingsgate, the porter's job to transport the fish. So the buyer makes a deal with the fish merchant at the stand or on the telephone, and then there's a large area where a ticket is issued, given to the porter takes the fish to the buyer's van. And that sounds obvious as a way to organise things. The speed at which they do it is phenomenal, and the pressure to do it, and also the pressure to get it right, because you can see all the boxes are white polystyrene. There are seven different sizes of prawns, and you've got to, as the porter, you've got to just glance, and you're sharing a chiller space with 12 other merchants, and you've got to know where your corner is, you've got to glance at those boxes and pick the right one out immediately. You can't go and get your glasses out and peer closely. So the way that the porters have a skilled vision too, but they're not actually looking at the fish directly, they're just reading the boxes.
My question is about price, because you've talked about value and hinted that it's mutable and there's a kind of spectrum to it. But when we saw money, it was in the form of price, and that was quite certain. And prices, as we saw from Marta and Dan, they move in leaps rather than on a sliding scale.
Yeah.
So I guess, could you say a bit more about mutability of price and where that appears and where the negotiations on that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously very important and quite difficult to ascertain. I think the things I can say about it are that price does, in a quite direct way, depend on availability and desirability. But there's the sort of fish that, so we're talking about fresh fish, not frozen fish, which is much more stable as a commodity. But when there's bad weather somewhere, that everybody is obsessed with the weather at Billingsgate and in the fish business generally, not just fishermen. But so when there's bad weather, they're already anticipating the consequences for a few days later. So they know how long a certain fish will last and still have value up to a certain point, and will still retain the same value, so they don't have to drop the price. So they play around with it. So they think, well, I know I'm not going to get more mackerel, but this mackerel will, actually mackerel's not a very good example because you have to get rid of mackerel really quickly, but I'm not going to get more cod, say, in the next 3 days because there's a massive storm from the people in the area where the boats are going out. So I'm going to keep this back an extra day. Then I'm going to be the person on the market tomorrow that's got cod when nobody has. So, but it's, you know, those are the judgments that they're making all the time. And if you get that wrong and you get stuck with something that starts stinking, then, you know, that costs you. I mean, the money that we're talking about that are tied up in different orders are tens of thousands of pounds. So, and businesses can fail because they got their Christmas orders wrong. You know, if you overorder your salmon and your lobsters, and you're left with suddenly a massive debt in hundreds of thousands of pounds, that's it, you can go under. I mean, there's not, they know what they're doing at Billingsgate, so the sort of established traders like to tell those kind of stories about the newcomers who don't really know what they're doing. But there is evidence of turnover and of failing businesses. I was going to say something else about price. Yes, what you saw a couple of images where there were prices. Well, I did a day's work at Billingsgate, as you well know, which I'd like to talk to you about as well, another point, which was a lot of fun. And I ended up talking to some people that I didn't know were traders, so buying for fishmongers' shops, because Billingsgate is also open to the public. So I thought they were members of the public. It was a Saturday morning. And I said to this guy, I remember, you know, look, I've got these really great wild sea bass, you know, this is where they came from, you won't get anything better, because I've been told I had to, you know, prepare my pitch. And I said, you know, I can give you a good price on them, and he went, I don't think so, I think I'll get a better price already, because he was dealing a different kind of, well, the deals he was making price-wise were completely different from what was displayed for the public. So most of those prices are displayed for the public or the small buyers. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of Chinese buyers in the market, and there's lots of buyers that would buy, you know, more than for a single household. There might be several households that are buying together, so you know they can get some improvement on price, but there are still two different kind of levels altogether.
Thank you.
But there's no data published on price at Billingsgate. There used to be, and it was extremely controversial, so they don't publicly publish data on price.
Okay, I have one question from you.
Well, Lynn posed my question. I can just thank you, and the pictures are fantastic because
yeah,
I get cold
true.
Feet and I always feel the smell, so I just want to compliment you on that.
Thank you. This is a shot from a film that I made based on time lapse photography,
mm-hmm.
so
oh, okay.
It's the same image all the way through the night,
mm.
so it's on YouTube. and you see an hour of the market in 30 seconds.
Oh,
so
okay. Oh,
you
yeah.
can spend the night there in 6.5 minutes.
Yeah.
We have one question over here, and then I think we're kind of out of time. I'm not sure how strict you are.
We can stay for a discussion, but I know you've got to run off. So. We can take over your chair.
It's not urgent, but yes, okay, let's continue.
Well, I'll just be very quick. It just follows on the last one, but I mean, as we all know, the thrust of the kind of anthropology of calculation literature is that people can't compute stuff like this, so we have to distribute it. And this is just incredible. This whole market, and there's no published prices. There appear to be no devices. I mean, is this all just
telephone?
That's
yeah.
that's all.
Yeah. And there's when I worked there, there's a drawer just full of cash. But the people there are incredibly fast. They do have calculators. But mostly they can do it in their head.
Just in terms of mapping prices and supply.
Yeah, no,
you'd
be people are walking around with notebooks. The buyers have, but you know they've established relations over years. Usually that they're going to two or three people or different people for different things. But in terms of the skill of the fish merchants, the sellers, they not only are incredibly good at arithmetic, but they're incredibly good at judging the fish, the weight of the fish. So I was having to weigh the fish and then work out the price. I was embarrassing that I couldn't add up for the first hour. some things came back to me. But whereas the guy that I was working for was looking at the fish and going 3.6 kilos, you know, like just, and I'd put it and it was like 3.55, you know. So there's this is kind of attunement at lots of different levels to that environment. And it's very unusual as a market actually nowadays compared to the ways that lots of other markets have gone.
We have a question here.
Yeah.
think my question or comment actually picks up from what you were saying, because in 2015 this market doesn't have to run this way, it's deliberately being run this way as a performance, as you point out. And it is interesting that of all the sort of centuries-old markets, Billingsgate is the one that makes it into popular culture quite often, I think because of the visual strength of what's there, which is very clinical. So that the white kind of lab coat and the white hats that they wear and the white polystyrene and the, you know, gleaming floor is a very big part of that performance, which is really striking just from your photos. It really is interesting. And it doesn't have, I mean, they could run a market on YouTube if they wanted to, from the port, with the fish still alive, if they wanted to. But this gives much more cachet to the fish. Yeah.
I mean, you need a point of concentration.
Yeah.
You'd have, you know, if everything, I mean, there are, of course, lots of different markets and lots of different ports, but the point is, you know, to have a point of concentration that then things get dispersed again out to lots of hotels, restaurants and fishmongers.
Exactly, but the capital then transfers, because you go to one of the restaurants in, you know, that get their fish direct from Billingsgate, and you're told the fish comes from Billingsgate.
Yeah. Yes,
and
it does
from
Billingsgate. Yeah.
Wow.
Lots of connections now as well.
Yeah.
That there are some traders that also own restaurants, and there are two traders that there's no gutting or filleting on the market floor.
Mm-hmm.
There are two traders that have separate spaces out the back where they gut and fillet and prepare fish for restaurants, and they argue that the knife skills have gone out of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Because chefs are just saying, I want halibut, but I want it in these portions. I don't want to deal with the whole fish myself.
I'm also curious to know when the cleaning happens and who does it.
You need to watch the film for that.
11 o'clock in the morning.
Is that it?
Thank you.